Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today, we're bringing back the director of the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities to share the word about important work that agency is doing, promoting racial and social justice, and inviting you to an upcoming virtual training to help folks who are inspired to lead learn how to run for local and state public office. Then we'll reconnect with our friends at the Child Health and Development Institute to talk about the intersection of social-emotional learning, which is growing in popularity in our schools and communities, and how it can and should be connected to teaching about anti-racism and equity. Then we'll close learning about Resources Education Support Together, REST, a peer-led mutual aid group for families with a loved one suffering with substance use disorder, and how you can get involved in an upcoming virtual training session on the issue absolutely free. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Make-A-Wish Connecticut wants you to make 2021 the year you get fit and give back with the Trailblaze Challenge, a 26.2-mile endurance hike where participants tackle the terrain of nearby Bear Mountain all in one amazing day. The Trailblaze Challenge is a hike, not a race, and caters to all levels, from novice to advanced outdoor enthusiasts. To learn more, Make-A-Wish Connecticut is offering a free virtual information session, and they begin on Tuesday, February 23rd, this Tuesday. But these sessions are offered different days and times throughout February and March. So to find out more and register, just visit trailblazechallengect.org. Well, we're opening this morning with the first of a couple of segments that are going to be focusing on racial justice and equity. But in our first visit, we're welcoming back Joe DeLong. He is the CEO and Executive Director of the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities, who represent most of the municipalities, either directly through CCM or their city. Their small towns initiative, the sister agency or subsidiary. Joe, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me back on. It's always always a lot of fun.
So we're going to ask you in a minute about CCM and all of the orienting people on all the things that you do. But in particular today, we're going to be talking about what I think is one of the most important ones, and that is both how you provide ongoing training to both municipal elected officials and municipal administrators and employees so that they can do their job better, but maybe even more importantly, helping those who are being recruited or are inspired to step up and try to serve in public office, how to make that happen. You are hosting workshops called Representation Matters. Are you ready to run for local office? One of them just completed, and the next one we want to fill up and help you pack on February 27th. These are free online training. And we'll also be talking about that in a little while. But really, CCM is many things to many parties here in Connecticut. Give us a little bit more detail on what CCM is all about.
You know, essentially, what we are is an association that represents the towns and cities all across Connecticut. And our role is very broad. What I tell people is, if you wonder exactly what CCM does, look at us as an extension of town or city hall staff. All the things that maybe they don't have the resources to do individually, we are able to provide the resources and the tools in order for them to be able to accomplish those things more collectively. So we do everything from municipal trainings, as you mentioned, compare and a lot of data research. We do a ton of research for our communities. We train newly elected officials. We offer a significant amount of subject matter expert workshops. We have energy programs that our towns and cities participate in. Then a very large arm of our organization is actually called KIRMA, which is the Connecticut Interlocal Risk Management Agency. And most of your local government property, casualty, and workers' compensation liability insurance is purchased as part of a risk management pool through CCM.
Right.
So there's a wide variety of things that we do. It's funny, a lot of people know us, the people who do know us, a lot of people know us for our public policy advocacy work. They look at us as like a lobbying arm in Hartford or at the federal level in Washington, D.C. But that's only a very, very small portion of our operation.
Very, a lot of taxpayers may not realize how much CCM and the small town subsidiary make a difference in their own pocketbooks. As you mentioned, the underwriting insurance agency in effect for most Connecticut towns and cities, instead of them having to go to the retail market for all of those various insurance products, it's all handled under one umbrella through KIRMA here in Connecticut. But also, I mean, you got a municipality, maybe you know, a small town that's now looking at something like maybe the cost of initiating some sort of a, you know, a solid waste hauling contract because they want to start phasing out their local municipal landfill. They might call CCM for data or some comparative analysis on what other cities and towns roughly their size might have done or are considering doing, and the cost implications of that. So a lot of really intricate data crunching on the part of your staff there too, on behalf of all of Connecticut's taxpayers.
Yeah, there is. And you know, we compare not only best practices across communities of similar demographics within Connecticut, we also compare those best practices within the demographics of the Northeast, and then of communities of similar size or demographics nationally.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we really become a clearinghouse for information and really help guide our cities and towns of how they can make the most fiscally prudent decisions, contracts. Again, most people would be surprised at, you know, how many schools and town halls and things of that nature are actually are lit and functioning because of CCM energy programs and how we're able to purchase electricity in that for communities at a massive discounts from what they would do on their own out there having to face the market alone. So
There's
a variety of programs that we do. And ultimately what it all comes down to, frankly, is whatever our communities tell us their need is. You know, it's not, we always encourage, especially newly elected officials, but don't think of CCM as, I think of you as an organization that does X. And we're an organization that does whatever it is that there is a void that you need us to help fill and assist you in.
Right.
That's our role, is to respond to their needs.
And what would communities do if political vacancies opened, especially on top leadership, mayors, selectmen, boards of selectmen, boards of finance, common councils? What would happen if openings developed and there was nobody to step into those positions, or perhaps a person that might not necessarily be going into it for the appropriate reasons? This is one of the reasons why CCM and its training, including the one coming up on February 27th, is so important. So we're in a beautiful place with you guys today, Joe, because we're in a position to be able to talk about how the one that already happened on February 13th worked out, and still open up an opportunity for folks to sign up on the 27th. And I guess the first thing we should qualify is, just because you sign up for this free online training on February 27th, Representation Matters, doesn't mean that you're going to then just suddenly turn around and approach your town committee or put in a petition to your town clerk to run for political office. You can take this workshop out of general interest for something that might be quite a ways down the road, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the one thing that I want to, you know, obviously make clear, and it's not a requirement because we do have all kinds of people who are interested in these, but these particular trainings have been geared toward the segment of the population of people of color. We, you know, that's the training that we have going on right now. Now, we have had you know, people who are Caucasian who have called up and said, hey, can I participate too? And we say, absolutely, we're not going to exclude anybody. But one reason why these this particular set of trainings were put together was we have a real lack of diversity in terms of our municipal representation. It doesn't line up with the diversity of our state. Currently, our municipal CEOs, we only have, out of 169 towns and cities, we only have two municipal CEOs that would fall into the category of non-white. The mayor of Bloomfield is the only black CEO in the state of Connecticut. And then the first selectman, Kathy Eno, also is a non-white first selectman. But that is it. And what we find is government, and I use this analogy all the time, that government and the economy are very similar in the fact that they both work best when everybody has access and everybody can participate. And when you start to get government that's a little bit out of balance, that doesn't represent the diversity or the demographics of our state in a more accurate way, then sometimes people feel a little more disenfranchised or a little less connected or feel their voice isn't being heard.
Yeah.
And when that happens and they don't participate, that's not good for any of us.
Yeah.
So that's what these trainings are really focused on. This particular set of trainings are finding people of color who are interested in being a part of the process, interested in being a part of the equity type work that we're doing, and then giving them the tools and resources that they need, not only to run for office, one thing to run for office, but also to be positioned to successfully govern when they get in office.
Yeah.
And that's vitally important as well.
Yeah. And I have to say, Joe, when people who look at their community's leadership and that leadership doesn't look like them, there inevitably has to be some degree of a feeling of exclusion. And once that that ink gets into the well, it is as you said, it creates myriad issues in communities. So quite important to begin to engage individuals and recruit and attract and train and help individuals get into government offices so that they can create an upper level of leadership that represents and looks like the community.
Yeah, no question about it. And the other thing that we see, whether it's minorities or whether it's, our white audience, we see what happens a lot of times, particularly at the local level, is someone will get into office, will run for office for a specific reason. Something that they're upset about. Maybe they just don't like the fact that the speed limit is too high on the street where the children are playing. Mm-hmm. It could be that type of thing. Something that they're passionate about that they think, I'm going to get in office and I'm going to do something about this. And then they get elected and they get into office and they have all of these other responsibilities that are laid at their feet. And they say, oh my goodness, I didn't know I signed up for this. I didn't realize I had to do all of these things. And before they know it, they're so overwhelmed by those responsibilities, they forgot about the stuff that they were actually passionate about to begin with.
Hmm.
So that's one of the things that we try to do, too, with these trainings on the front end. Now, we do train a lot of newly elected officials, and we have a lot of newly elected officials that we can kind of watch the color go out of their skin,
sure,
on their face when we tell them everything that they need to learn and what they need to be doing.
Yeah.
But this training here in the front end on the 27th, it's really all about, the first part of it that we did with the campaign school at Yale was how do you run? How do you successfully run a campaign? But this second part of this training that's still open that people can register for the 27th is more of a, if you get elected, here's what you need to know to be successful. Here are the things that you need to understand. And it's really remarkable when you come to think about it. Let's say that I go to a local restaurant on a regular basis, and I have lunch or dinner with a couple of my friends. Of course, that even seems foreign now with the pandemic, but we all know, sure, that the pandemic won't last forever.
Right.
that's just a normal thing that I do. But now all of a sudden, I'm on a board of selectmen. And those friends of mine who I've been friends with for years, they also hold some type of officer on a board of selectmen as well. We go to our regular lunch. We might be in violation of something because we're now, you know, have an official, we have a quorum of a meeting. Without putting out public notice and doing all those types of things. People don't think about that stuff when they run for office. They say, hey, these are my friends that I've gone to lunch with. You mean I'm in violation of something now? I could actually be in trouble, you know? So
all well and good till the FOIC comes calling.
Exactly. So we work through all these nuances with people just so they understand them. And there aren't things that present themselves that inhibit their ability to be impactful in their communities. Because what we don't want people to do is come in with great intentions, get frustrated, and turn around and say, I can't make a difference. Because if you're prepared, you can make more of a difference holding office at the local level than you can make at any other level in government.
Yeah.
That's why we want to have good people in local office, because their decisions really do directly impact the lives of everyone around them in their community.
Yeah. And Joe, I would take that one step further. You and I have both been in the sidelines of Connecticut government long enough to have seen the person who doesn't like the speed limit on their street take that passion, parlay it into a successful run for public office at their local level, police commission, council, what have you. And then suddenly, 3 years later, 5 years later, then maybe they're running for state rep. And then 5 years later, 10 years later, those people end up governor, lieutenant governor. They end up in high level, commission seats or in the Connecticut State House or beyond U.S. government service. The sky's the limit, but you can't win if you don't play, to quote another agency's catchphrase. So it's all about getting involved, and especially folks from among our BIPOC communities. We want you to run for local office, and it all starts with the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities and Representation Matters. They're free online training coming up on February 27th. So Joe, as before we say farewell, just let folks know where to go to sign up, and we hope they come rushing at you and pack this workshop.
Sure. Well, just go to easy website link, ccmcares.com. Just go to ccmcares.com. It'll take you directly into where you can register for these workshops and get a lot of other valuable information there as well.
Excellent. We appreciate you coming on and talking about this. The one-day intensive training from the School for People of Color with a newly discovered or revived passion for politics is going to provide you with the foundation and skill set for launch as a community leader. It's coming up on February 27th. We hope you'll join it. And in the meantime, Joe DeLong, CCM CEO and Executive Director, we thank you for your time and appreciate all the great work you're doing here in Connecticut, and we'll talk to you again soon. Well, as I was saying to my next guest before we turned on the microphone this morning, it's been way too long since we brought an expert voice from the Child Health and Development Institute, CHDI, onto the award-winning For the People. And we're pleased that Jason Lang is back. Jason is the Vice President of Mental Health Initiatives at this organization, a nonprofit that is working always to improve the health and well-being of Connecticut's children. Myriad initiatives, efforts, papers, workshops, seminars, briefs, all available for you to review if you care about Connecticut's kids at chdi.org. Their latest work is just a few days old from its release on February 10th as we broadcast this, and it is an issue brief entitled Improving Students and Staff Well-Being During COVID-19 and Beyond, Connecting Social Emotional Learning with Anti-Racism and Equity. So we have talked as recently as just a couple of weeks ago about social emotional learning and how important that is, not only in a school environment, but in families and communities and even the workplace. But the fact that there is now some intersection with the opportunity to bring anti-racism and equity education into the mix, it was too exciting to pass up. So I'm really excited, Jason, that you've been able to make some time today to come on and talk about this important issue. Before we get started, though, just refresh people a little more than that simple introduction on what CHDI is all about.
Sure. Thank you, John. It's great to speak with you again. CHDI is a nonprofit where our mission is really to improve the health and well-being of Connecticut's children. And we work with really any child-serving system, including behavioral health systems, schools, primary care providers, child welfare system, juvenile justice, to improve the quality of care and mental health services that kids get. And we are excited to put out this issue brief, and I'm thrilled to be here to talk to you about social-emotional learning and anti-racism.
Excellent. Well, I'll read from the introduction, paraphrasing that the pandemic really has resulted in additional and ongoing adversity, trauma, and behavioral health concerns for many students and staff in Connecticut's education arena, and has disproportionately impacted those of the BIPOC communities, the Black, Indigenous, and people of color. The pandemic has also accelerated previously growing interest among school administrations in addressing behavioral health and wellness to optimize school climate and academic achievement. And these comprehensive approaches to supporting student and staff wellness are often centered in social-emotional learning. Concurrently, the racial justice reckoning in the U.S. and here in Connecticut and in our communities has highlighted the intergenerational racism, discrimination, and trauma experienced by these BIPOC students, staff, and their families. So let's start the conversation first talking about SEL programs and how they're becoming so effective and increasingly available in Connecticut schools, Jason.
Sure. Well, SEL programs are widely available now. Most schools and districts have these programs, and they're really focused on developing the skills and awareness necessary to be a productive and successful student and ultimately member of society. And schools have increasingly been doing this because there's good research showing that SEL programs have a number of benefits for students as well as the schools. And those include improved skills and awareness about, social situations, social decision-making, recognition of one's own emotions and feelings. They also include reductions in behavioral health concerns like anxiety and sadness and depression. I think the real selling point, or one of the real selling points for these SEL programs, is that they also help students academically. So there's good research showing that they are associated with improved school performance, test scores and grades, as well as the social emotional benefits.
Yeah. I guess a decade ago, if you mentioned to any educator or even administrator in Connecticut, social emotional learning, the brow might furrow. 5 years ago, probably a lot fewer brows would furrow, but it was really just over the past 5 years that social emotional learning has really kind of peaked on the on the bar chart here, and it is talked about and being applied everywhere. Has CHDI been following social emotional learning in respect to other areas of your interest as an agency prior to this idea that it could provide an important intersection on anti-racism and equity?
Yes, we have been following and working a bit in the area of social-emotional learning. Our approach has generally been really a whole school approach, what's called a multi-tiered system of supports that looks at student needs in terms of social emotional learning and behavioral health across the continuum from social emotional learning programs, which are more universal and geared towards, you know, all students in a building or in a district, all the way up to programs for more higher need or higher risk students that are identified as having more significant concerns that, you know, might need mental health treatment or other services beyond social emotional learning. So as part of that multi-tiered system of supports and kind of a comprehensive look at how schools can address mental health, SEL programs is really the, you know, the foundation, because it is universal and it really should be what schools build a lot of their, you know, their supports around.
Yeah. And I guess it, from a greater good standpoint, it's really impactful because so much of what our young people learn about for the first time in school comes home and then gets planted like a seed and grows and hopefully benefits not just the immediate family, but their entire neighborhood and community. Is that something that you have seen coming out of social emotional learning? Because guests on our program have been talking about how now, you know, multi-billion-dollar global corporations are interested in training their staffs in SEL, and there's all kinds of non-educationally centered SEL or SEL flavored initiatives that are going on in communities and neighborhoods.
Yes, absolutely, and I think it is it's certainly important to keep in mind that SEL programs are really best done when they include the family, the community, the whole school, and when they're not, you know, they're not focused specifically on changing individual child's behavior or thinking or, you know, emotional regulation skills. And then the ways that you described, you know, that is the ideal and the goal, that it teaches, you know, it teaches children skills, but it also helps them to bring them back to the family, the community. And a lot of it is around relationships. You know, how do we have successful, productive relationships with others? And I think that's increasingly a skill that, you know, is needed. And, you know, for too long was, you know, as you said, was not really as valued in schools as the academic support and academic skills.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, Jason, but when we come back, we're going to talk about why introducing principles of anti-racism and equity into SEL programs can broaden, and as we can easily see how as SEL practices are coming home and proliferating in families, neighborhoods, and communities, this component of anti-racism and equity coming home and proliferating in similar ways can have a significant great benefit and jumpstart efforts that might otherwise take a lot longer from a top-down approach versus when they're starting with the youngest and sometimes most influential voices in our communities, our children. We'll be back to talk with Jason Lang more about this intriguing new brief from the Child Health and Development Institute when we come back. Jason, stick with us, folks. We'll be right back. Do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by our radio station. This is John Boquet, your public affairs director at Connoisseur Media. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Domestic violence is a public health issue that's been deeply impacted by the COVID-19 crisis. So our radio station invites you to join BH Care's Umbrella Center for Domestic Violence Services and its virtual 14-day challenge honoring victims and survivors of domestic violence. The money raised will support domestic violence programs and victim advocacy services at BH Care, including the Umbrella Center and the Hope Family Justice Center. Sign up for the Strength for Survivors Challenge and get ready for an empowering and inspiring challenge starting on March 13th. Challenges can be done by people of all ages and abilities, so get involved now by going to s4s.bhcare.org. That's S, the number 4, s.bhcare.org. We're back. Thanks for sticking with us. Jason Lang is with us. He's Vice President of Mental Health Initiatives at the Child Health and Development Institute, CHDI, a great resource for our award-winning For the People and for the people of Connecticut, especially if you're interested in your child getting more information and empowered with anti-racism and equity information. That is the subject of the latest issue brief from CHDI that Jason played a role in. So Jason, we set this up talking about SEL and its importance in education and in our communities and workplaces. Let's talk about your idea about bringing principles of anti-racism and equity into SEL programs vis-a-vis your latest paper.
Sure. Well, I think the reckoning that's happened nationwide over the last year or so or longer around racism and discrimination really prompted us to think about how to bring this information into a number of different programs. And so in terms of SEL, I think there are a number of natural ways where anti-racism and equity just fit within what SEL is trying to teach. So I think SEL programs can certainly recognize and affirm all students' diverse backgrounds and cultures. And it can include information and discussion about racism, discrimination, bias, microaggressions, you know, all of these things that we know BIPOC people are and students are experiencing in their everyday lives, including in schools. We know it happens in schools. There's been quite a few examples in the media of this. And so when we're teaching children with SEL programs and instituting these programs in schools around how to manage your emotions, how to have social skills and positive interactions with others, how to identify others' emotions, it's critical to bring conversations about discrimination and racism into those SEL modules and curricula.
So if I understand correctly, in reading the brief, the work of school districts in incorporating diversity and multicultural awareness into their curricula and professional development does not go far enough to address the fact that BIPOC students are more likely to experience these exclusionary discipline and arrest situations and to be identified as disciplinary problems rather than being appropriately screened and identified as having a mental health condition. This sounds like taking that extra step of really laser focusing on principles of anti-racism and equity really have the potential of kind of turning the tide on a really, really long-standing and highly impactive, educational practice and onus on our education system and our communities.
Yes, I hope so. And I think that SEL programs are one, you know, important way to do that. They're certainly not the only way, and there are many other school policies and programs that, you know, could also do well to incorporate anti-racism and equity. And as you said, many districts are beginning to do this or have been doing this already. I think there's quite a bit of variability, but we still see disproportionate arrests, suspensions, expulsions for students of color. And so I think incorporating this into SEL is really, you know, one of the foundational components of that multi-tiered systems of support. And it's something that all students are exposed to and that really should be responsive to this, you know, this push and need to address anti-racism and equity and discrimination in everything that we teach.
Well, Jason, before we let you go, we first want to thank you for your insight into this issue and the suggestions we're going to talk about and recommendations for advancing anti-racism and equity in SEL programs. But first, also must shout out Jamie Locurdo and Gianna Bracey, who apparently were your colleagues in developing this specific report.
Yes. And Jamie and Gina both contributed to the report, and thank you for calling them out. They've been terrific.
Great. So in closing, Jason, apparently there are a handful of recommendations for advancing anti-racism and equity in SEL programs. Let us know what they are so parents and caregivers and educators and other interested folks in our communities can begin to perhaps do their own thinking and advocacy on that front.
Sure. Well, in terms of schools, I think schools can certainly take a look at their SEL curriculum and begin to integrate, if it's not already incorporated, components of anti-racism and discrimination. I think they can also look for models that have been developed or are being adapted in this way to include that information. There are a number of SEL programs out there. There are lots of them. And I think more and more we're going to see them begin to include this information. Mm-hmm. And then parents and caregivers can certainly talk with their children about discrimination and racism. Also talk with their schools, talk with the leaders in their districts or in their school buildings about whether this is being included. And I think schools often hear a lot of the complaints and criticisms, but if there are ways that it's already being included and positives, it's just as important for schools to hear that as well.
Very good. And I understand that there's an organization called the Education Trust that has developed a toolkit, which could be a resource for educators, administrators, and districts to support the process of integrating anti-racism and equity into the curriculum.
That's right. Yes, the Education Trust has a toolkit. The link is in our brief. And there are some other resources, too, through the CASEL framework and some others that we link to in the brief that can be used as starting points as well.
Excellent. And a final question or final point I'd like you to help reinforce is when a lot of people hear these programs and they somehow are separated purposefully or unconsciously from the issue, they don't have kids in the schools, they're not really so engaged that they're really thinking a lot about anti-racism and equity, especially in the education arena. The thing that I think you can help people understand is how the issue reaches into their pockets and how in the long term this type of training actually will have a financial benefit to districts in terms of the amount of money that's being spent and in society on mitigating issues with individuals who may have faced expulsion, who may have faced arrest or some other actions or discipline in the school system when in fact all they needed was the right referral to the appropriate mental health care.
Yes, exactly. And social emotional learning is a, as I mentioned, it's a universal approach. It's a relatively inexpensive approach to addressing these skills and issues early, before more serious concerns develop. And that could be mental health condition that needs more costly treatment or services in school or out of school. And it could be an arrest or suspension or other things that are, more likely to happen down the line if we don't intervene and address the issues early.
Yeah. And on the other hand, the likelihood that bringing what is learned about anti-racism and equity home through the eyes and input of our children and young people at school will undoubtedly have a crossover effect, not only in families and neighborhoods, but throughout entire communities here in Connecticut. And there's nothing wrong with that either.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jason, thank you so much. It's always great to talk with the Child Health and Development Institute and you and your colleagues. We appreciate your time and especially the hard work in developing your latest issue, Brief Number 80, which talks about connecting social emotional learning with anti-racism and equity. You can read or download the brief or learn all about CHDI and all of the other great work and products and publications that they have available for you just by going to their website, CHDI.org. Jason, appreciate the time today, and we'll talk to you again soon. I love making new friends, and we certainly have one on the line here today to wrap up our program this morning. You know, every day more and more families in Connecticut are affected by substance use disorders or realize they have a teen at risk. We talk about it here on the program a lot. And that's because it's happening a lot in our families and neighborhoods and communities here across Connecticut and in the listening areas of all our radio stations. Well, great news. On March 3rd, a local organization, A Promise to Jordan, that you've heard about here on our program, and their founder, Lisa Gray, she's hosting a virtual seminar that teaches techniques for motivating substance users to seek treatment. And with me today is one of the presenters. It's Lori McDougall, and she's founder and executive director of REST. So, Lori, resources, education, support together is your organization, and it all came from your own personal story. Tell me a little bit about your experiences with your son.
Back in 2012, my family were heavily embedded in the community. I was living in Simsbury at the time, and I have three children, two daughters and a son. And my husband and I did not know, we had no idea that, one, opioids were even out there, that heroin was being used. We thought that was really a drug of like the 60s and 70s and that it had gone away. One morning, I discovered my son in his bedroom, overdosed. And, it was really, not a good overdose, if any overdose is good, but in that they needed four doses of Narcan in order to revive him. And even after reviving him, after a few hours, he again went downhill and ended up on life support for a couple of days. He did survive the overdose, but this was our family introduction to the opioid epidemic. And this was the first time that I was starting to realize that opioids, heroin, and of course now fentanyl, were a part of the drugs that a lot of our kids, our young people, young adults were using.
Yeah.
So it was a struggle.
So at that time, at that time you were a math teacher in the community, very embedded,
yes,
very civically active. And now through this, you have formed this Resources Education Support Together, or REST, which is a peer-led mutual aid group for families with a loved one with substance use disorders. And in that short amount of time, you've really made a name for yourself as a resource. You're hosting podcasts, you're a guest author, co-chair of the Family Task Force in Rhode Island. You're very, very busy. Let's talk a little bit more about REST. Is it the same as other support groups like Al-Anon or Nar-Anon or Narcanon? If not, how is it different?
It's extremely different. So on my journey, and having that experience of finding my son, I ended up being diagnosed with PTSD. I had about a 6-month period where I really struggled to grapple with what was going on and to deal with my own, personal depression and PTSD brought on by finding my son. But what ended up happening is I decided that I would do exactly what my son's treatment facility was asking him to do, which was 90 meetings in 90 days. And so I started going around from state to state, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. I think I hit every Naranon and Al-Anon meeting that you possibly could, sometimes one, two, three times a day. Mm. And what I found was they were extremely helpful, incredibly, incredibly helpful. But what I found was there were some missing pieces. There were some things that I wasn't getting any kind of skills or strategies to help me deal and cope with my son and his substance use disorder. So at the time, a cousin of mine was going through the same situation, only her situation was happening about a year ahead of us. And she called me up one day and said, "Hey, Laurie, have you heard of this methodology? It's called CRAFT, Community Reinforcement and Family Training." So I went and looked it up. You know, she had said, "I think this is something you're going to like. I think that it's right in line with how you think." So I looked it up and I found a website, this website called Allies in Recovery. And the entire Allies in Recovery is based in this methodology, CRAFT. So I took a look at this particular methodology and I started implementing it in my own home and with my own son. And I started to see some positive change in the direction of how I dealt with him. And CRAFT gave me some, I call it like some meat, something to bite into.
Yeah, yeah.
Something to, yeah, right? Like something to do as a family member, a loving family member, that I could find some way of influencing and directing my loved one into a more positive direction.
Yeah, things you can do versus what you can't.
Right, exactly. It's more, it is a much more strength-based type program for families. Mm-hmm. So what ended up happening is, and I'm totally forever, forever grateful to the Naranon and Al-Anon meetings that I went to. They were incredibly supportive and helped me to recover in my own PTSD and my own depression. But I thought, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we had a group similar to Al-Anon and Naranon that not only worked on the individual and helped them to cope with their own struggles, at the same time we could teach skills and strategies and all sorts of different coping skills, like how to set healthy, effective boundaries, how to use reflective listening to really help your loved one solve their own issues. Wouldn't it be great if we had a group that offered that type of a group? And that's how REST got started.
And so now, you're bringing REST to the table along with a another colleague to present another alternate idea at this event that's coming up on March 3rd via Zoom.
Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit, first of all, about how you became acquainted with Lisa and A Promise to Jordan.
Actually, I actually knew Jordan because that we can start there. I knew Jordan. My husband and I owned a bagel shop in Simsbury that it's a very community-based bagel shop. And so Jordan used to come into the bagel shop all the time. Mm-hmm. I was also a high school math teacher there, and I knew of him from the high school as well. Mm-hmm. And then so that happened with my son, way before Jordan. And then this happened with Jordan, and we're still connected with everybody in Simsbury. And so it kind of came to light, and I started to see Lisa creating her organization, A Promise to Jordan. And I actually sent her a letter via Facebook and said, "Hey, I know you're doing some really good work in trying to bring all these different resources to the community. Have you taken a look at," and I wasn't even promoting REST at the time. Mm-hmm. I was promoting the Allies in Recovery website. Mm-hmm. which is where I had first gone to in order to learn craft. Mm-hmm. So I kind of brought that to her attention. Mm-hmm. And it took her a little bit of time, but she connected with Dominique Simon Levine, who is the creator of the website, Allies in Recovery.
Oh.
And when she,
the other event presenter. Oh, great.
Exactly.
So all together now, the three
exactly.
of you. Fantastic.
Exactly.
Well, tell us more about the event.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I am really, really looking forward to it because having the opportunity to reach out to families with this type of a program to help support families in the multitude of communities that are in the state of Connecticut is, I want to get it out there as much as I possibly can because I want families to know that, and I'm sure Lisa wants families to know, that there are things that you can do, that there are some positive, really, really positive strategies that you can use to help create a better connection with your loved one and to help kind of influence them in a way that is a lot more positive.
Yeah,
and so I think it's amazing what Lisa is doing and trying to bring all of these different resources to families and to the community. It's going to be a great event.
Well, as folks may remember from our visit with Lisa earlier this year, A Promise to Jordan is a nonprofit based in Simsbury, named for Simsbury High School graduate and her son, Jordan, who died from an accidental opioid overdose in 2018 at age 24. So this event within the envelope of A Promise to Jordan is bringing together Dr. Simon Levine, who is the CEO of Allies in Recovery, AIR, and mm-hmm. that organization is sort of the inspiration under which you formed your organization, Resources Education Support Together REST. And it's
exactly.
all happening absolutely free. People can sign up. It's a 6 p.m. Zoom event on March 3rd. And in order for people to register, they just need to go to email Lisa at A Promise to Jordan. And it is info@apromisetojordan.org. And we'll give that one more time before we say farewell. But in the last 30, 60 seconds we have with you, Lori, let people know how they can learn more about REST.
Oh, sure. Awesome. If you want to know more about REST, you can always get in contact with me at lcmac11@comcast.net. But also another way to kind of look into REST and stay in contact or to find out more, our website is www.resthelp.org.
Excellent. Well, it was great to meet you, Lori, and best of luck to you. So happy to hear that things are going better in your family. And we hope that anyone listening will sign up for this free Zoom event coming up on March 3rd at 6 p.m. via Zoom. Once again, to register, they just need to go to email info@apromisetojordan.org. Best of luck with the event, and thanks for being on the program. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.